Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It is good to see you. I'm so glad that you are here. I'd like you to take your Bibles and let's turn together to Matthew chapter 16. Matthew chapter 16. And we find here a familiar text. And it records a message from Jesus to his closest disciples. The timing here is the winter before his death. And Jesus brought his disciples to this region of Caesarea Philippi. And it was here with his disciples that he confirmed to them that he was indeed the Jewish Messiah. And then he foretold some things concerning his church. And so it gives us a little preface on what we are reading here in Matthew chapter 16. I want us to begin at verse 13, if you'll follow with me. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, "Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" And they said, "Some say John the Baptist, some Elijah, and others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." And he said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Simon Peter answered and said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I also say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. And I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." So it's not an unfamiliar passage. We've heard it before. It's a very authoritative passage from which many gospel sermons have been preached. It was a message directly here from Jesus to his disciples, and it's a powerful enough passage to stand on its own. Little commentary is needed. And we cannot make what Jesus said any more authoritative. Now, there's some different conclusions held by some on what Jesus was referring to or what this means. But when you think about and you consider carefully the context in which he said these things, I think the message becomes clearer. And in this case, it might be helpful for us to understand something about the place where they were standing. So we spend a few minutes here doing a little geography work, just thinking about and trying to understand where was Jesus and where were the disciples with him when he said these things. Now, you might be familiar, you know, with the map of Palestine of old. And so we're trying to just get a picture of some things here in our mind, of some things that were going on. You know, this Bible story takes place about 30 miles or so north of the Sea of Galilee. Or that puts it 155 miles from Jerusalem. Jesus in his ministry spent some time in Jerusalem, and of course, quite a bit of time in the region of Galilee. And so we're a little farther north than that. If we take a closer look here on the map, we see the Sea of Galilee and Capernaum and some places where Jesus spent a lot of time. But look, we're farther on up. We're up the Hula Valley. And we are up here in the area of Dan, the Old Testament city of Dan. Caesarea Philippi was only about 4 miles from there. And so this is the only time that Caesarea Philippi is mentioned in the Bible. Well, it's in Mark 2, but it's the same account, same event that has taken place. Now, there's quite a few Caesareas throughout the Bible land, but this is Caesarea Philippi, not to be confused with the Caesarea over on the coast, Caesarea Maritime, but this is here in this northern part, north of the Sea of Galilee. Well, the area, long before there was a Caesarea Philippi, is an area where there was a lot of Baal worship, a lot of worship of foreign and false gods. There's kind of an interesting history behind that during biblical times. Now, there's not really a lot in the Bible about that area, but there's enough for us to learn what was going on and what the area was known for. And so long before the event that we're reading about now in Matthew chapter 16, it was an area or it was a region that was known as a place of Baal worship. Let's think about some biblical history for a moment. In the early record of the children of Israel, we can see and understand that Baal worship took place in this area. And to be sure, not worship about Jehovah God. We're talking about Baal worship, false gods, idols. And it's only about 4 miles or so away from that ancient city of Dan that we mentioned, where the first king of Israel, Jeroboam, you know, built the golden calf, remember? And so that was, I just imagine that was easy to incorporate in their worship because around them already was a lot of Baal worship. The region was known for that. And why was this place chose, you know, by Jeroboam, other than the fact that the whole region, you know, had a lot of Baal worship? Maybe it's just because it was a beautiful area. And here's a picture of Mount Hermon as it looks today. And throughout that valley, it's very fertile. It's a very nice area, a very beautiful area. At the foot of Mount Hermon, there are springs of water. It's a fertile valley. And in the Bible times, and we look at biblical history, it was called Baal Gad or Baal Hermon. And just a couple of examples, there's more, but just a couple, you know, recorded in Joshua chapter 11, from Mount Halak to the ascent of Seir, even as far as Baal Gad in the valley of Lebanon, known as Mount Hermon. He captured all their kings and struck them down and killed them. Speaking about some of the battles that Joshua was leading the children of Israel in. And I reference that just to make the point that that area was well known for its worship of false gods and foreign gods. Later in 1 Chronicles chapter 5, so the children of the half-tribe of Manasseh dwelt in the land. Their numbers increased from Bashan to Baal Hermon, that is, Sinor, near or Mount Hermon. Just saying, this whole region that we're looking at here was an area that Baal worship had taken place for generations. And so even in the time of Jesus, it was still an area that was known for that kind of worship. Why it got started there, why there was so much, and there was Baal worship everywhere. I'm not saying it only happened here. I'm just saying it was just so prevalent in this region. And so Baal Hermon, or Baal Gad in the Old Testament, is an area that was later called Panias. Panias, after the Greek god Pan, who was worshipped there. And so Panias was the location of the cave of Pan. It was a site where worship of this god took place. And it was the pagan place of the Gate of Hades, they called it. A little more about that here in just a moment. Now today, it's called Banias. They can't seem to get down to one name they stay with. Now it's called Banias. There's actually an Israeli national park there. And it's a place that actually thousands of people go to every year, in part just because of its ancient history with the gods and all. And biblical history is what takes people there. And so in the first century, now we come back to where our story is taking place in Matthew chapter 6. We come back to the first century now, and the city is called, changed names again, Caesarea Philippi. And it was situated on the southern slope of Mount Hermon. Caesarea Philippi is the location of one of the largest springs feeding the Jordan River. So we're at the river head of the Jordan River. There are three springs in particular that feed the Jordan River. Here's where it starts. And of course, we read about the Jordan River so many times, you know, in biblical history. And this is kind of where it starts, at this spring right here. So there's an abundant water supply, and that's part of what makes the area so fertile and attractive for religious worship that continued there for generation after generation. And this, Banias Spring, is one of those three primary springs that feeds the Jordan River. And along this area, along this river, there are numerous temples built around that area in the Hellenistic time, the Greek period of time, and in the Roman periods. So what does this have to do with Matthew chapter 16? Just stay with me. We need a little history here to understand what's going on. Caesarea Philippi in the first century was a city that served as an administrative city for Philip the Tetrarch. This was during the time of Jesus. The city was built around Panaeus Spring, as it was called then, and the spring was named after that Greek god Pan. Later in the first century B.C., back up a little bit before Christ, Herod the Great acquired the land in this region, and he built and constructed there a huge temple. A little later, in the 3rd century A.D., Philip the Tetrarch founded the city of Panaeus, and he built there large temples in honor of Pan, that Greek god. And he built these temples along the rocky ridge of Mount Hermon. Herod Philip enlarged the city and later named it Caesarea. Caesarea, after the emperor Augustus. You know, if you were a tetrarch, you would want to do what you can to please the emperor. One reason why there are 14 cities in what we would call the ancient Bible lands named Caesarea. A lot of governors trying to be good with the emperor. I'm going to name a city after you, Caesarea. That's what we're going to call it. Caesarea Philippi, because Philip was the one that founded the city, he got his credit there too. And again, it helps us to distinguish between Caesarea Maritime over on the coast and all the other Caesareas throughout Asia Minor and what was Palestine at the time. So that's kind of where Caesarea Philippi came from. And so we see and understand in the first century, the city was used as a administrative center for the governor. And it was a city that was well known for its worship of Greek gods. And in fact, Philip helped to encourage that because he built some large temples there, in particular temples where worship to the god Pan would take place. And so it was very much a focus of Baal worship. And in fact, you know, when you come to this area around Caesarea Philippi, you come to this cave. And where there's the river that's flowing right here. And this is the site of those temples that Herod built in the first century. The foundation of those temples are still there. And this is the cave where the worship took place, you know, for this Greek god Pan. Boy, there were some weird things that happened here, though. You see, the spring that came out of the cave, just inside the spring was a very deep pond that some at the time said it was limitless, it was bottomless, and it just amazed the pagans when they came there to worship their god. And there were a lot of sacrifices that were made right here to Pan. Pan is this god that maybe even you've seen before in some readings that you've done. He was half man, half goat. Remember, he had a head of a man, but then he had a goat body. And sometimes people say, well, how do we know what he looked like? Well, coins. His depiction was on coins. That's how we know a lot of things about how things looked in ancient times, because it was on coins. And that's how we know how Pan looked, at least in their mind. Remember, he's just a Greek god. There was not actually... not someone called Pan. He was a Greek god. But it was here at this location, at this site, where Herod built temples, where worship was done. And there was a temple that was built right in front of that cave that you see there. And water flowed out of the cave. The water doesn't come out of the cave now. It comes out just in front of the cave, as you see here in this photo. Earthquakes and things like that made some changes and kind of changed the flow of the water. But there was the time in the first century where the water flowed out of that cave. And there was that deep pool there. And it was there that they made sacrifices. And so what they would do is they would offer goats. And they would throw the goat into that water inside the cave. And if the goat sunk, well, it indicated that Pan accepted the sacrifice. But if the goat survived and came out, it meant that Pan rejected the sacrifice and another sacrifice had to be made. But it had to be a greater sacrifice. And what was offered was babies, infants. were thrown into the cave, thrown into that pool, and they were given and offered to their god, Pan. So that's what's happening in Caesarea Philippi. That was happening throughout that region. It was an area of worship to the gods of men. But right here at Caesarea Philippi, it was known for its worship of Pan. Right here in these temples that had been built by Herod. And so we stop and we think for a moment, and you are wondering, what does this have to do with Matthew chapter 16? Well, I think there's an interesting tie. Now I want to say something again, a point of emphasis here. We read Matthew chapter 16. We're going to read it again in a moment. And we can read that passage and we can understand exactly what Jesus wants us to understand. We can understand what he is saying, what he is foretelling concerning his church. We can understand that without knowing anything about Caesarea Philippi of the first century. But I think it's interesting to understand something about the history that's there. And it might even give us a deeper understanding and appreciation of some things that Jesus said. So right here at this site in Caesarea Philippi, you can walk around the right side of the river, the water that's coming out of the ground there. And as you walk around, there's a pathway that'll take you right up to where the ancient temples were at. And it's a very interesting moment to be able to think about what was going on right here in the first century. What Jesus would have seen, what his disciples would have seen, what they would have known about. You know, worship of the Greek god Pan was not done in a vacuum. It wasn't like they didn't know what was going on. They would have understood well what happened right there at that rock. You're in the foothill of this is built into the rock of Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon rises just beyond this. You're at the foothills of Mount Hermon is where this rock is at and where these events were taking place. But it was here. It was here that Jesus chose to use this place and this location to make the revelation that he has made in chapter 16. Now, we don't know exactly where Jesus and his disciples were standing. Were they right here at this spot? Or were they somewhere closer to the city of the center of town? I have no idea. We don't know anything about that. But they were in the region. They were here in Caesarea Philippi. We do know that. And everyone knew what happened in Caesarea Philippi. Everyone knew that the focus of all that happened there was worship of their gods, in particular that of Pan. That was understood by all. Then it was here that Jesus chose to reveal to his disciples that he was the Messiah. Remember in our reading, I mean, it was here that he is revealing to them, so there is no doubt, there is no question in the minds of anyone that he is saying to them, that he is the Jewish Messiah. He is the one that was prophesied about. He is the one that was foretold. It was here in this place that he spoke about establishing and building his church. That's something he revealed to them. It was here that he said to these disciples that they would be given great authority in preaching. You know, that they would be given keys to the kingdom of heaven. You know, keys open doors, right? That's what keys are for. And the door of faith would be open to the Gentiles, we read in Acts chapter 14. I think there's an interesting connection to be made there. It was here that he announced his coming death in Jerusalem. And it was here that he told his disciples that his earthly ministry was coming to an end. But it would mean the beginning of theirs. That they have work to do. That they would be given authority, that they would be carrying forward his will and his word. These are the things that happened here in Caesarea Philippi. We go back to Matthew chapter 16. Will you look with me? Matthew chapter 16, we begin now in verse 18 again. And I say to you that you are Peter, And on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. And I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. And then he commanded his disciples that they should tell no one that he was Jesus the Christ. And from that time on, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed and be raised again on the third day. If we could even imagine being there with Jesus, being one of his closest disciples, and being there with him in Caesarea Philippi, knowing all that happens and goes on in that region, and now having this conversation with the Lord as he was asking them questions, and Peter responded, and then Jesus makes this revelation about the things that are to happen and take place. If we could just imagine being there and hearing these things. When I think about this particular site, and I think about the things that Jesus said, looking at the remnants of pagan worship all around, it helps me to get a very powerful meaning from this text in Matthew chapter 16. What Jesus was saying contrasted all that pagan worship was about. There are things that he is saying that denounces pagan worship. When you walk into this site right here, you can see the foundations of the temples of Pan that were there. But you also can't help but notice these niches, as they are called. These niches that come inside are carved inside of this rock cliff. There are some that are very big. I could stand inside that one there. It's very tall. But most of these carved into the sides are maybe this tall. And what these are for is, this is where they would place their gods, their idols. They would put them in these niches. And so people would come here to this site, of course, to worship the god Pan. That was the big god there. But there were other gods too. And idols would be placed here in these niches. And maybe there were some smaller figures of Pan that were there. And Pan's father, Hermes, and the sculptor of Echo, the mountain fairy. These were all gods that were prevalent in the first century and would have been worshipped here. And you can just picture and you can imagine that when you would come here, there would be people bowed down and laid prostrate before these gods, worshiping and maybe throwing their money there in front of their gods. And inside these niches, there are inscriptions. And it's names of people. Presumably those who helped to finance, you know, this site. Because I suppose if you have your name carved in a niche, it gives you a special place in the eyes of their gods. I don't know. But those carvings are still there. But here's the bigger picture. It was standing here in the center of pagan worship that Jesus brought his disciples to announce his church. It was this site. It was here in Caesarea Philippi that Jesus brought his disciples. Now, this is a long way from home, so to speak. And it's the only time that we know of that Jesus was in Caesarea Philippi, that he had gone this far north. It was here that he brought his disciples to make this announcement that we've read and to tell them about things that were to happen, things that were to take place. It was here that Jesus brought them. Maybe it looked kind of like this in the day. This is just an artist rendition. But if you take the foundation of the temples that are still there today, and again, how would they know what this looks like? Coins? inscription on coins of the god Pan and his temple in Caesarea Philippi. That's how they know it looked something like this. Again, this is just an artist rendition, but it's based on what you find on coins. And so you can see how the one temple is built right into the face of the cave, where they would offer their sacrifices into the cave and into that water right there. And in it, such a powerful statement that Jesus made use, and he used this setting to make this authoritative declaration concerning his church. It was here that he said these things. And so we try to imagine this rock cliff and the temples that are there, the temples to the god Pan in the background. And with the idols of Pan and other gods, these gods built by and chiseled or carved by the hands of men, displayed in such a prevalent way. And people coming here, you know, to bow down and to worship these gods, these stone gods or these gods made of metal or gods carved out of wood, sitting on the niches of this rock that had gods that did not have the power to fashion themselves or to pull themselves in out of the rain or to pick themselves up when the wind blows them over. It was here that men went to worship these gods. This is what happens here. And for generations, the foolishness of man has been demonstrated by his desire to come to this rock and to bow down before objects that he's made with his own hands. That's what's happening right here. And with the spring pouring from the cave that had accepted so many fruitless sacrifices offered by the hands of men, that it was here that Jesus declared his authority given by the power of God. It was here Jesus made this statement. And on the confirmation from Peter that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, emphasis. He is the Son of the living God. Jesus declared his sovereignty and his rightful place as the one who has heaven's authority. Something that will be reaffirmed in the next chapter. The Christ, the Messiah of which the prophets foretold, the one who has the rightful position of authority, chose this place to announce his church. There is on the one hand the rock that is represented by the best of man's imagination. This site in the rock or on the rock that was made and developed by man to worship his gods. Powerless gods of man's design. As being compared now, Jesus is making a comparison here. These gods made by the hands of men compared to Jesus the Christ, the Son of Jehovah God, the Creator and Maker of all things. A comparison in which there is no comparison. There's no comparison of Jesus to these gods fashioned by the hands of men. Jesus demonstrated his sovereignty, his power and authority by speaking and fulfilling the words of the prophets. He confirmed that he was the Son of God with all power of miracles that came by his hands, proving that he, in fact, was the living God. He was demonstrating these things. And at that moment and in that place, there could be no reasonable mind that could not see the foolishness of man's efforts as compared to that of Jehovah God's ultimate will to rescue man from himself. That even in view of the foolishness of man, God had sent his Son, who came to save man from his sins, from his own foolishness. It was an incredible moment in time. Why would anyone choose to follow the empty words and the powerless abilities of those who touted the works of their gods? Their gods had no works. Their gods had no power. And to think and compare their gods to the Creator of all things is just an incredible moment in time. The promise of true hope, the church belonging to Jesus, an incredible promise that came from the Son of God, the only one with power and authority to make the pledge that he made. Based on the affirmation of Peter that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, Jesus declares, on this rock. Oh, there's been some interesting ideas about that. On this rock. And what is that? And what does that mean? On what rock? Was Jesus making some affirmation about the rock cliff of Pan? Is that the focus of Jesus? Well, there's no power there. We already see that. And all that's left there today is rubble. The god Pan is no more. And all the other gods that were displayed there, they're gone. There's rubble. There's not even rubble concerning the gods. There's the foundation of the ancient temples, but that's all that's there. What happened to the power of those gods? Well, they never had power. And so what is this on this rock? What is that to mean? On this rock, is that Peter? Some have said so. Peter, is he the rock? Some assert that, but if that were the case, then that would make it Peter's church, wouldn't it? And wouldn't he be the one we worshiped? If the statement were true and it was a reflection of Peter. Listen, Jesus has not brought his disciples here to make a statement about Peter. Peter is not the focal point. Jesus is the focal point. Jesus is the one that they have that they have confirmed and that they have confessed is the Christ, the Son of the living God. He is the focal point. And it is Jesus who said, "My church, I have come to build my church." Possessive. It belongs to him. Singular, belongs to him. The rock is Peter's confession of faith in Jesus Christ as God's Son. Jesus is the rock. A fact that would be proven by his resurrection, you know, the basis of faith. Jesus is the rock. That Jesus is declared to be, Paul said it this way, to be the Son of God with power according to the Spirit of holiness by the resurrection from the dead. Romans 1 verse 4. Jesus is the rock. The rock that Peter acknowledged is Jesus the Christ. And Jesus declared his church and the power of it. He said, my church. I want you to look with me. We're going to several passages now. Turn with me first to Colossians chapter 1. Colossians chapter 1. In this text written by the Apostle Paul, this first chapter is speaking so much and making such a focus on Jesus the Christ and his preeminence among all and above all. We step into that storyline here in verse 15 when it says of Christ, he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For by him all things were created that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers. For all things were created by him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things he may have preeminence. Again, a powerful statement about the church that belongs to Jesus. God designates that it belongs to Jesus, the church, that is, that it's his. And if we think some about foundations here, you know, the foundations of the temples of those gods lie in ruins. The gods are no more. They're not there. Even those built on the rock of Mount Hermon had no firm foundation on which to build. No foundation in that those gods had no power, no authority. But God declared that Jesus is the foundation of God's building. Let's look in First Corinthians. 1 Corinthians chapter 3. 1 Corinthians chapter 3. Maybe a little bit of insight here about Christ's church and its power to stand, its foundation. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, beginning at verse 9. For we are God's fellow workers, you are God's field, you are God's building. According to the grace of God, which was given to me as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation, others and another builds on it. But let each one take heed how he builds, for no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Christ's church stands strong. There's no weakness in the church. I'm the church he built. You know, sometimes I hear brethren say, oh, I don't know what's going to happen to the church as time goes on. I'm concerned about this or that that's happening in the church. And sometimes we say that as we're making some reference to some things that are disturbing. Some movement, some ideas of men that seemingly is carrying brethren this way or that way. And sometimes we fret about, oh, what's going to happen to the church? Let me tell you something. The church is just fine. The Lord's church is strong. The Lord's church is built on the foundation of Jesus Christ. The church hasn't moved. No, I'm not saying that men haven't moved. I'm not saying that men haven't gone the wrong direction. But let's understand something, please. The church is just fine. The church that Jesus built exists. It is strong as it's ever been because Jesus hasn't moved. We just need to make sure we are aligned with him. That's what we need to do. The Lord's church is fine. There is one house that is firm, and that's the household of the Lord. Ephesians chapter 2. Ephesians chapter 2. We begin at verse 19. Now, therefore, you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and of the household of God, and have been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building, being joined together, grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are being built together for a habitation of God in the Spirit. The church is just fine. The church that is built on the rock, the church that is built on Jesus Christ, the church that is built on the foundation that Jesus Christ represents, he being that chief cornerstone, that holy temple of God. We become that holy temple of God. He is the rock and cannot be moved. In a very clear statement of the pre-existence of Jesus, Paul declared the spiritual rock that overshadowed Israel. Going back to 1 Corinthians again. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians 10, beginning in verse 1. Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be ignorant that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea. All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, all ate the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them. And that rock was Christ. The rock? Is it Peter? I don't think so. The rock is the Lord. We're talking about something that's immovable. Something upon which we can build. We're talking about something that has all power and strength. Jesus the Christ, the one with all authority, the one who has come, he came and he proclaimed the building of his church, his kingdom. And so once again, a statement about the place and the position of Jesus as the Son of God. What was previously seen as he was previously seen as a shadow of what was to come, but now is. Many events in the days of the children of Israel represent types that find their way to Christ. Such as the rock at Mount Horeb that provided water for them to drink but saved them from death. Was a type of Christ who would save the world from sin. Today, baptism in water washes us in the blood of Christ so that we might be saved by sin. And here is described a spiritual rock, and that rock is Christ. What a difference. This rock, what a difference than was represented by that temple of Pan, which was powerless and would save no one. But we find salvation in Jesus Christ. He is the power to save us. Through his blood, Jesus came to build his church, into which all of the saved of the world would be added. And later, the disciples that Jesus was speaking to in the crowd on that day in Caesarea Philippi, they would see it happen. They would see the will of God proclaimed. In fact, some of these standing with him would be the ones who would proclaim the will of God on Pentecost in Jerusalem, where his church was established, where it began, where the first baptized believers were in Christ. That's what Jesus was talking about. And gave them the authority to go and to preach and proclaim his will and his word. So that today we can become baptized believers in Jesus Christ. Our sins removed, our sins washed away. And to be added to his church. The church is strong and it's powerful as it's ever been. We just need to make sure we are a part of it. That's what we need to do. And so I hope this view of Matthew chapter 16 is helpful for us to think about these things and to put some things in perspective. Now, in the next hour, I want us to keep studying here in Matthew. Our plan is to go to chapter 17. There's another event that takes place in chapter 17 that is pretty incredible and very powerful. And that's where we'll go in the next hour. Thank you so much for listening so well.